Somalias have long been at the crossroads of the exchange between cultures, yet the social lives of those who inhabit the region are often framed as marginal to historical narratives. And while scholars have studied religious diversity in the context of modern nation-states such as India, Pakistan, Tibet, or Nepal, seldom has the Himalaya been the focus of examination in and of itself. Megan Adamson Sijapati and Jessica Van Tine Birkenholz remedy this scholarly void in their new collection of essays, Religion and Modernity in the Himalaya. The volume explores religious responses to Himalayan modernity as witnessed in the cultural encounter with new social realities, expectations, and limits. The characteristics of the Himalayan region are fluid, moving beyond geographical boundaries or mountain and valley zones, as are the contemporary human processes of meaning-making in the face of globalization and modernization. In our conversation, we discuss how modernity operates, the social and political factors shaping the Himalayan religious environment, processes of emplacement, Tibetan Buddhist media, environmentalism and development, changing pilgrimage practices, the Nepali goddess tradition, political limits to religious education, and the dynamics of perceived margins and discourses of peripherality. I'm one of your co-hosts, Christian Peterson, and thanks again for listening to New Books in Religion. And now my conversation with Megan Adamson Sijapati and Jessica Van Tine Birkenholz about religion and modernity in the Himalaya, published with Routledge in 2016. Welcome, Megan and Jessica. Thanks for joing me on New Books in Religion. How are you?
Doing well. Good. Thanks for having us.
So this book, Religion and Modernity in the Himalaya, super interesting collection, fruitful way of framing the volume in terms of kind of thematic patterns that are coming out and some of the ethnographic detail that authors go into. So I'm excited to talk about how this all came together. We always start with a little bit about you guys, though. So could you talk a little bit about what brought each of you to the study of religion, perhaps mentors or moments that were influential in perhaps bringing you to South Asia and the Himalaya region, or the types of approaches that you guys take?
Yeah, sure. So thank you, Christian, for having us, inviting us to talk about the book. We're really excited about it. It was a fun project, and we're looking forward to a conversation about it now. How I came to the study of religion, I guess I'll go back only as far as college, but I studied at Colorado College and there majored in religion, but studied philosophy, religion, dabbled in some Sanskrit, and ended up in Nepal on a culture and society immersion program for my study abroad, and was exposed to the really fascinating and complex mix of Hinduism and Buddhism that one finds there. At least that's all that I saw then. I would come to learn of more religions there later. But that really piqued my interest academically in religious studies. And then I went on with some diversions here and there, ended up at the University of Colorado doing a master's in religious studies there, where I focused on South Asia and women and gender in South Asia mostly, but then ended up working with Fred Denny too in my first study of Islam. Wasn't sure if I was going to go on in the graduate study of religion or not, and then spent the summer in the Punjab on a Punjab studies program run out of UCSB, and ended up just being pretty blown away by the mixture there that I saw of Sikhism, Islam, Hinduism, religion and politics. Just a fascinating world to me that compelled me to want to go on and pursue religious studies even further. So went to the University of California, Santa Barbara, worked with some really terrific people there, and focused on South Asia, but particularly on Islamic traditions of South Asia. So came at it from that, and here we are today. So that's a bit of my background.
My background is quite similar to Megan's in certain ways, insofar as my interest in religion began also as a undergraduate student in college, though I kind of came to the study of religion via classics, and I was really interested in the classical languages and classic Greco-Roman mythology and religion, which led me eastward to Hindu mythology, which led me to Hinduism. And I spent my junior year abroad And part of that was in Nepal. And that just, that was a game changer in all sorts of unexpected ways. I was absolutely amazed by everything I saw. And I was so curious about everything I was seeing and hearing and smelling and encountering. And it just raised a lot of questions for me about the vibrancy of religion, which was new in my own personal experience. And so I returned, and the same professor at Vassar College who taught me Latin and ancient Greek then taught me Sanskrit my senior year. And that really solidified my desire to go on to graduate school. I had a fellowship after graduating from college to do some independent research in Nepal for a year on women's traditions. And this is when kind of my interest in women's traditions and women in religion really started to develop more. The Hinduism factor was already pretty well established at that point. And going on to graduate school at the University of Chicago to study with Wendy Doniger was the path that seemed to be the only path for me at the time. And I was very interested in textual aspects of Hinduism and kind of came to the ethnographic side of it later. Ultimately, started off at the Divinity School, ultimately got my PhD in the Department of South Asian Languages and Civilizations, still under the guidance of Wendy Doniger. And interestingly, I think it's worth noting that a lot of those of us who work in Nepal and the Himalayan region kind of get our first, get our feet wet on these study abroad programs. And so I, along with many other individuals that I know who did study abroad programs as undergrad students, our dissertations and later our first book projects were based on independent study projects that we did on those study abroad programs. And that was my experience. And so, I always like to kind of give a shout out to the importance of these study abroad programs. And that's kind of how I ended up where I am today.
Yeah, that's interesting how there are many parallels between the two of you. Could you talk a little bit about how you guys teamed up and then how you started to bring this collection together? Where did it emerge from and how did it move forward, the project?
I'll say a word about how we teamed up and how we met, and then we could talk about how the project itself emerged. So getting back to study abroad, of course, both of us ended up pursuing field work in Nepal and our graduate work for our dissertation projects. I think we were both on Fulbright Hayes dissertation fellowships right. Based in Kathmandu at a pretty tense time. This is when projects outside of the Kathmandu Valley were almost impossible to undertake. It was the height of the Maoist insurgency or the People's War. And there were, curfews and buns, which is the term that's used when everything is shut down in the city, schools, roads, all that. It was a really, really crazy and interesting time to be in Nepal. And we were both in the valley with a handful of others who were doing their dissertation work. And I think we met on one of the Fulbright gatherings, or I can't remember what it was, but we kind of hit it off right when we met. There were a lot of great people there at that time. And of course, we're doing quite different projects as well, as Jessica mentioned, hers, or she'll talk more about, but on women and gender and the goddess traditions, and doing a lot of textual work as well. And I was working on a project among the Muslim minority in Kathmandu and studying the emerging Islamic revival movements there, which, again, to return to study abroad, were things that I didn't even see or were aware of when I was a study abroad student. So often it takes multiple journeys to a place to even have your eyes opened up enough to see some of the things that are right in front of you. So that's where our friendship and our working relationship started, because we would exchange ideas and talk about the progress of our projects and field work under kind of intense conditions, including, evacuation at the height of the war and so forth. And the transition from Nepal being a Hindu monarchy to no longer having a king, all of that was taking place at that time. So there was a lot to talk about and collaborate about, have great discussions about. So that's how we first began talking about our work and working together.
Yeah. And from there, we, building off of that foundation, we would see, we became conference buddies. We would see each other at conferences, most often at the annual conference on South Asia in Madison, Wisconsin, every fall. And it was actually at one of those conferences in Madison in 2010 where we started talking about this kind of our respective work and the region that we work in, the Himalayas, you know, our field of religion, and realizing just how that there seemed to be a dearth of material on religion in the Himalayan region. There's been an extraordinary amount of really excellent work done on the Himalayan region. This is often usually done by anthropologists and geographers. They have really kind of dominated Himalayan studies throughout the history of Himalayan studies. And we were, you know, kind of lamenting or taking stock of the fact that how few of us scholars of religion there were engaging in the region explicitly. And so that kind of sparked this idea of, well, let's see what we can do about that. And let's start a conversation. And it was Megan who had the specific idea about modernity in the Himalayan. She can say something more about that in a second. But we started, you know, asking questions about kind of the conversations that we'd like to have and thinking about those in the field or closely related to the field that might be interested in partaking of these conversations with us. And so we organized a double panel at a 2011 conference, the first Himalayan Studies conference ever. So there's the Association for Nepal and Himalayan Studies that both Megan and I have been a part of for a number of years. I'm on the executive council board now. Megan was on the executive council for a while as well, predating me. And I'm also the reviews editor for the journal associated with the Association for Nepal and Himalayan Studies, which in shorthand we refer to as ANHS. We now have periodic Himalayan Studies conferences, and we organize a double panel for the very first of those Himalayan Studies conferences on religion and modernity. And it's from those that we got our first collection of papers for this volume. And then later on, we solicited a few others and presented these papers again in different iterations in a couple of subsequent conferences, both again Himalayan Studies conferences and the annual conference on South Asia in Madison, to finally get a group of really solid, interesting papers, dynamic papers that engage with these questions of religion and modernity in great ethnographic detail. Megan, I don't know if you want to say something more about the specific idea.
Yeah, the idea of the how we conceptualize this, even in its earliest stages. I mean, Jessica spoke to the fact that there were scholars of the Himalayas presenting at the South Asia Conference, and then there was a Himalayan Studies Conference. And, you know, there's been, I wouldn't say a tension, but kind of this ambivalence about where do the Himalayas fit in region. And we can talk more about the region of the Himalaya later, if we like. But, you know, the Himalayas are typically not recognized so much in the study of South Asia. They're seen as peripheral, which of course geographically they are on the periphery, but I mean, even just in terms of the lived traditions, there may be a paper here or there, there may be a panel, but again, it might be about environmental science, it might be about development. But so we were kind of feeling out and playing with this tension between, you know, how do we foreground research in the Himalaya, but also be thoughtful in our interrogation of what it even means to invoke the Himalaya. Like, what is that region? And is it, you know, do we want our studies of that take place in the Himalaya and documentation of lived religions and lived traditions there best situated within South Asia or within its own area called the Himalaya? So we didn't really set out to necessarily answer those questions in this volume, but rather to ask them and kind of ask them in a formal way in what seems to be, you know, one of the first times that you have a grouping of scholars work together to speak to those questions. And we also wanted to, I mean, I think documentation was an important process, one of our concerns too, mm-hmm. our interests, right? It's just, who's out there that's, who's doing close ethnographic or field work, close textual work, studying lived religion in the Himalaya? Who's out there and where, let's bring these, let's document some of not just the work of the scholars themselves, but of course, much more importantly, the traditions themselves and the voices of people of the Himalayas. Let's get some of this together and in conversation with each other. I think too, we wanted to see what kinds of potential there was for, or what kinds of shared experiences or orientations or challenges that religious communities face in the Himalaya might be similar across the different subsettings of the Himalaya. So, are there shared experiences? Are there shared challenges or dynamics or processes, in one community in this part of the Himalaya and another community in this part of the Himalaya? Or are they really distinct? We argue, and I think the book really fleshes this out or bears this out, that there are commonalities across the Himalaya. But we were trying to at least begin a conversation about this and try to engender this conversation and also document at the same time what we know about lived traditions. There's been a great amount and very excellent scholarship on, say, for example, Tibetan Buddhism, right? Or that's probably the best example I can think of, in which it's a discrete tradition in a way. And so you have scholars who may come together, say, at the AAR or other conferences and have a Himalaya panel or a Tibetan Buddhism panel, but it's just Tibetan Buddhism in all of its variety, but it's within that larger umbrella of tradition. We wanted to bring multiple traditions together to see if there were shared processes that we might identify, or if the contrasts were something that warranted new, interesting questions and conversations.
Yeah, I think for me, the volume worked very well in kind of showing those thematic traces that are found across traditions. For many of us, we're outside of this this region, though. So I think maybe now would be a good time to help us think about this region, the Himalaya. What exactly are we talking about when we're talking about the Himalaya? What are some of the key social and political factors that shape your subjects? What would we need to know as a novice to get into this collection?
Yeah, that's a really good question. What constitutes the Himalaya is certainly a question that a lot of us think about who work in the region, and there's not necessarily one easy answer. What the Himalaya is, it depends on who you're talking to. It depends on your perspective and what context, what you're referring to. So we can think of it, there are certain countries that are all part of the Himalaya in different ways, right? The Himalaya is not its own nation state, obviously, but it encompasses this mountainous area that we find in Nepal, Bhutan, Tibet, Pakistan, Afghanistan. But it really depends on who you're asking and why you're asking, both if you ask a scholar, if you ask a local person living in the Himalayan regions, how they would define it, you might get some very different answers. And even for the Association for Nepal and Himalayan Studies, this is something that we're constantly grappling with, or with the journal Himalaya, that is the journal for the association, constantly thinking about, well, is this book appropriate to review for this journal? Or is this article dealing with a topic that is relevant? Is this area part of the Himalaya? So there are some very kind of specific questions surrounding the Himalaya in that sense. But as Megan so wonderfully illustrates in her introduction to the edited volume, there's a lot of other questions about what constitutes the Himalaya, right? That these are, as I said, a lot of different countries belong to the Himalaya, but no country in its entirety necessarily belongs to the Himalaya. Megan, I don't know if you want to flesh that out a bit.
Yeah, sure. So for, you know, and in contrast to South Asia, I mean, this is a region that South Asia, for example, would be delineated by national borders for the most part, right? So, of course, those borders are somewhat fluid, and we know that cultures and traditions cross those borders as well. And Borderland Studies is doing, you know, doing a brilliant job in helping many of us to understand how that's the case. But in the Himalayas, it does, you know, it's a region that just doesn't line up with national boundaries in any clear way. Also, as Jessica mentioned, I mean, you know, it's a, we envision it as a mountain, or we conceptualize it as a mountainous region, but, you know, are the plains, you know, the contiguous plains, for example, the Tarai of Nepal, are they also the Himalaya? I think mm-hmm. our colleague Arjun Gunarana, for example, an anthropologist who's worked in the Tarai and written a lot about Nepal, would argue that yes, that is part of the Himalaya. So where do the mountainous ranges, you know, where does that end? Is it, you know, and how far, for example, west do we go, into Afghanistan, into the Hindu Kush or not? Some would say yes, some would say no. I'm working right now with Jacqueline Fuchs, who's worked in Ladakh, she's an anthropologist, and we're thinking about some of this as we conceptualize a journal volume, or a special issue actually in the Himalaya journal that's put out by ANHS, because we've put out a call for papers on the Himalayas, and actually on Islamic and Muslim traditions and cultures of the Himalayas. But do diaspora populations also count in that? Other parts of, say, Tibetan Muslim communities who are in other parts of China, would we consider that part of the Himalaya? I mean, you know, it just becomes increasingly complicated. So it's actually a really fun and interesting thing to, you know, I think question is what constitutes the Himalaya. And I think what we've enjoyed about this process of working on the book, and what we so appreciated from our authors, is that using the lens of religion, we can think about the Himalaya in a very particular way. We can see how, you know, maybe religion and religious communities or practices or particular types of discourses help us understand boundaries of the Himalaya in a different way than say a different frame would.
Now, the other part of the title here, you pick all these really complicated terms, right? Religion, modernity, Himalaya. Is the other factor here is modernity. So what do you all mean by modernity here? This is a fraught term. How did you see this as a kind of useful framework for the project? And, you know, part of what you do in the introduction, Megan, and then in some of the other subsequent chapters, how does modernity operate in the Himalaya region itself, which is not always the same?
Yeah, modernity, the beast of modernity. I was just reading, teaching my class, the Islam as a Foreign Country, you know, the great book by Zarina Graywall, and she talks a little bit about modernity, and she says, of course, modernity as an analytic concept, or modernities, is no longer even a useful one, because in some ways it is kind of an empty signifier. But then we felt that it does speak to something, though, that is worth talking about and that's worth trying to name. And modernity is kind of the best term that we came up with in trying to name what it was that we were seeing and thinking about. And I talk about this some at the end of that section of the intro chapter, and that is that in one way we're talking about this general experience of an awareness of the new. There's being something new, you know, and in across the Himalaya, and certainly in Nepal, which is what I'm most familiar with, and I think Jessica is too, is, you know, development discourse and talk about modernization is everywhere. It's ubiquitous. The presence of NGOs in the UN and the fact that Nepal was opened up to the outside world in 1952 only. And, you know, so modernization is something that is very concrete, and yet it's kind of a linear path forward, or it implies a linear path forward that's aligned with development in a way. But then modernity is something related, but bigger and more abstract. We find has salience. It is something worth talking about and trying to identify in the Himalaya. And that, again, is this idea that the sense among people and their practices and their the way they live religion, that there is something new out there, that there's either, whether it's in terms of development and there are new infrastructures coming into place, or their new modes of communication and technology and so forth, that whether they're experiencing that modernization, quote unquote, or not, they're still part of this experience of an awareness of something that's new. And that awareness, for lack of a better term, which we're naming modernity. So it's more of the experience and the awareness and some sort of almost milieu of sorts that we're trying to invoke with modernity rather than any sort of process or anything that has some sort of Western genealogy. That's not really what we meant by it. We wanted to talk about changing realities, inventive ways of living and being and surviving, and that the awareness of that and the need for that among people in the Himalaya could be described as modernity.
And with that awareness, there's also, that's paired with the sense that this modernization, which again is we're characterizing as different than modernity itself, that these other processes are imminent, right? And that they're also desirable. So having that awareness and that kind of expectation of change that's coming, if it hasn't already come already, or further change, as well as some kind of desire for that, and how to grapple with, you know, we were interested in seeing how these different religious communities and practices are coping with this and are managing this new engagement with modernity and how the practices are being affected by it. And one of the interesting things that I think that the volume does a really nice job of with the individual contributions is, again, with all of the rich ethnographic detail, and this was a clear focus for us as editors, that we really wanted contributions that were very rich in on the ground, right? In the thick of it, was that we found that there are multiple modernities, right? We don't want to suggest that there's only one singular monolithic modernity, but that what we're seeing in the Himalayan region are multiple modernities. And what do those look like? So again, in many ways, the volume ends up raising and asking more questions than it necessarily provides answers. But we think that this is a really, that these questions are important, and that we're looking to, as Megan said earlier, engender this conversation and allow it to expand and grow and invite others to partake in it.
Yeah, and you know, we don't use this term much in the volume. I have it a few places, I think, in the introduction, but, you know, another way of framing this could have been through globalization, which I think is a problematic term in some ways, or at least very complicated. But modernities, and if we're invoking multiple modernities as we are here, it's, I think, implies or at least includes the dimension of human experience, which I think comes across in all of these essays, is that they're not just a documentation of, you know, conditions and practices, and there's that lived experience that's attended to by each of the authors, I think. And I think a term, you know, modernity as a conceptual frame or as an analytical tool enables us to consider that in a way that say globalization would not have, and certainly modernization doesn't.
Now, when you start to get into these individual pieces, you frame the collection in two parts. And the first part is titled Space, Place, and Material Modernities. And here you have examples that deal with natural environments, the use of electronic media, different shifting types of genre materials that become popular. What do these essays try to accomplish? What ties them together? And what are some of the case studies that you put in this section?
I'll start with that. let's see. So, yeah, so we have three parts in this first part. You know, there's so many ways that you can frame sections in an edited volume like this, especially when you have great material to work with, which I feel we really did. We have a chapter on Kedarnath and the High Himalaya by Luke Whitmore. We have a piece on T-Pop and the Lama, which is about Tibetan pop. That's by Holly Gailey. And then we have a piece called Pocketing the Himalaya by Andrea Pinckney. And, you know, all three of these, I think they, like all the essays in the book, but all three of these are very specific and they're very close readings of these practices. So one is pilgrimage and the way that that's shifted. The other is, you know, this kind of subversive, kind of coded way of expressing political desires and religious desires, but through pop music. And then the other through, again, pilgrimage. So, but from a very different perspective than the other essay on pilgrimage. Jess, do you want to speak more to the specifics of those?
Yeah, I mean, I think that there's so much to say, but I think one of the as Megan said before, that the whole volume could have been structured in any number of different ways. But we found that these three pieces work really well together in terms of thinking about the material modernities, right? And space and place. So whole section is subtitled Space, Place, and Material Modernities. And so looking at pilgrimage pamphlets, these souvenir pamphlets for pilgrimages and pilgrims, and the ways that these have changed over time and have really facilitated travel to these four very important, prominent pilgrimage sites up in the Indian Himalayas. And in Holly Gailey's piece, looking at these video CDs, another form of media, which also ties in with the cell phone videos that are the focus of Luke Whitmore's piece on Kedarnath, and the ways in which these are, in their own ways, reproducing these sites and these places and these practices, but are also shifting the conversation and facilitating different kinds of engagements with each individual place or the idea of these places, and specifically in terms of the Tibetan experience in the diaspora. So there's a lot of interesting, so kind of holding on to these very specific material practices was the common thread between these three essays. But again, we could have organized this whole volume in any number of different ways, which we had, of course, discussed, which also speaks to kind of the fluidity of these boundaries, right? Not just in the Himalayan region, but within the different practices and the different cultures and communities, and the ways and the discourses that are circulating among them and materializing in different ways.
Yeah, and place, of course, it's in the title of our part one and part two. And place is just such an important theme across these essays, in part because, I don't know if we'll have a chance to talk about this later or not, but I mean, some of the themes that we drew out too were these ideas of one, peripherality, the other of emplacement, but the peripherality, the ideas that, you know, the way that centers and margins are conceptualized. And in this first section, while we're looking at the materiality of these lived traditions and the changes in these lived traditions, space is so important to all three of the ways, the way that material objects are used and conceptualized in particular places. You know, you have the Luke Whitmore's essay and Andrea Pinckney's essay, both dealing with pilgrimage and shifts in the movement of people, where many, many more people are able to attend these pilgrimages now than ever before. So how is that accommodated through, you know, video and cell phone videos, or through new versions of the Mahatmya and that are more accessible, kind of guidebooks for this pilgrimage? But then Holly Gailey's is quite the reverse, is that it's a more constricted, you know, there's much less movement, of course, in Tibet and among that community, and much less freedom of expression. So, you know, the material object of the VCD, which seems kind of antiquated, but is a very powerful still material object there for communicating symbols and messages and so forth, and through song, take place somewhere where there's much less movement, but the place itself is very important to what's being communicated. You know, the place of Tibet for Tibetans is central to their understanding of themselves and their religious lives. And so in that way, we felt that space and materiality played out in some really interesting ways, or our authors drew them out in some really interesting ways in those pieces.
And the second section, of course, deals with many of these kind of interrelationships, but you frame it around called gods in place, migration, deities, and identities. And here, really, at least for me as a reader, this kind of intersection of between place and identity seemed to be kind of the most prominent theme across the essays that you have in this section. How did you guys conceptualize these essays kind of complementing each other? And what were some of the examples that that worked for you in kind of thinking about place and identity?
So in this section, there are two essays, one of which is my own on a Nepali goddess tradition, the Nepali goddess Sustani. And the second is a piece called Adulterous Jyotial, or Protector of the Oppressed, about the god Ganganath in Uttarakhand by Radhika Govindarajan. And we're both dealing with questions surrounding important deities in two different communities. I'm dealing with this goddess in Nepal's Hindu communities, primarily, well, historically, Newar Hindu communities, but also for a long time now, the high caste Hill Hindu or Parvatiya communities who worship this goddess every year through a recitation of a sacred text associated with her. And in my piece, I'm looking to document some very prominent shifts in her tradition that have taken place very recently, after a long history of rather significant shifts, but also very remarkable stability. Those earlier shifts really ended in the earliest 20th century. And then we've had about a century's worth of a lack of overt movement in the tradition. It's not to say that there haven't been developments here or there, but within the last 10 to 20 years, there have been some very significant new shifts within the tradition, most specifically around the goddess and her finally being given a temple. Before, she was an aniconic deity who was worshipped only in the form of the text and only during this particular time of the year. And now she has a temple and is accessible 24/7, 365 days a year. And so thinking about place, her actually being grounded, fixed in a place, and how that's shifted her identity and her interaction with the community around her. And in Radhika's piece, she's looking to this god called Ganganath, whose history is in Nepal, but who migrates with Nepali migrants into the Indian Himalayan region of Uttarakhand, and is looking at how kind of different his identity and the identity of his devotees have shifted with that shift in place, and kind of how these different modern developments of migration and the relationships between the Himalayan region and the plains, between the Himalayas and India versus Nepal, how all of these dynamics play out, and we see them kind of performed within this one god tradition that she writes about.
Now the third
Megan,
section.
I don't know if you.
Oh.
Well, I was just going to say, I didn't know if Megan wanted to add anything to that.
One quick thing, to add is, I mean, thinking about these as distinctly Himalayan traditions too. You know, for goddess and varying forms of the goddess and the Himalaya they're quite distinct to what we would find in other parts of South Asia. And we see that, I think, you know, we see that in your chapter, Jessica, and then also in Radhika's chapter, this documentation and interrogation of possession is quite striking too, because that also is a practice that's understood, you know, as distinctly Himalayan. And so not that it only takes place in the Himalayas, but that it has very particular features in the Himalaya that I think scholars of South Asia would find pretty interesting.
Now, the third and final section of the volume is called Education, Governance, Official Discourses, and Religion. And here you have a sample of case studies that walk us through the kind of interesting dynamic here between kind of the lived religion that you've been talking about, but then a more kind of formalized way of conceptualizing these traditions. So what are some of the kind of main takeaways when we think about the case studies that you have for this third section?
Main takeaways. Well, you know, we do see institutions, the presence of institutions in these three essays more than we see in the others. And I think one takeaway from these pieces when we put them in conversation with one another is that official discourses, as we're calling it in the part title or the part three title, you know, official discourses and different forms of legislation and governance and then educational structures, they do play an important role in both limiting or providing the limits around which or limiting what changes can take place in the community, but then also they can serve to help create new changes and put into effect and make more official changes that people have been working on bringing into being for some time. So thinking, for example, about the waste management, which is documented by Elizabeth Allison. So waste management in Bhutan. And she looks at how official discourses and govern, you know, rules in Bhutan would dictate the way that, well, actually are telling people that they need to dispose of their trash in different ways than they understand to be appropriate to the way one is supposed to live on the land. And so lived religion, the way that they understand the trees and the nature of plastic and all of that and what kind of spirits live in those, you know, provide both opportunities for the state to rethink the way that they want to run their waste management program, but also present certain challenges. And in the case of, and the other two essays, Redefining Monastic Education by Nadine Platja and Schooling Virtue by Catherine Miller, which deals with Northern Pakistan and Ismaili communities there. Education is that official discourse and the kind of programs through which women, in the case of Nadine's essay, nuns can pursue, you know, greater gender equality, and that young people can, in the case of Catherine's essay in Pakistan, can pursue kind of a social upliftment and a kind of social progress. So I think what we really get from these three is that institutions can have a big impact, and that people also can impact institutions, and that religion in particular and the way that religion is lived outside of the official discourses of maybe central authorities of the traditions can have a big impact on day-to-day life as well.
Do you want to add anything, Jessica?
Well, I think Megan summed things up quite nicely.
I agree. No, I don't want to touch you.
So
the collection for me, it made me, think about this region in new ways. It wasn't really on my kind of geographical radar in terms of thinking about how this area might kind of make me think about how traditions change over time, how they adapt to new circumstances. You set this up in the introduction for the book, and you've kind of touched upon it here and there. But you did mention that these kind of dual themes that we definitely see throughout the pieces of peripherality and then emplacement. I'm wondering how you two conceptualize these through your kind of editorial work of reading through these in terms of gathering these together. How do these play out in the Himalaya region?
Do you want to start with that, Jessica? Or do you want me to start?
I'll just say briefly, you know, that these were two concepts that Megan identified quite early on, and that kind of through our discussions we were able to develop as important themes that run throughout. And really that's also in part because, you know, they do stand out in these different essays. So in looking at peripherality and the dynamic between center and margins, right? And the shifting between those and the perspective, which is always fluid and varying depending on who's the one looking or seeing or trying to articulate where the center is versus the margins and the periphery. And emplacement, again, you know, this has already kind of come up, the importance of thinking about community and persons with respect to space and place. And so much of what we're seeing in the Himalayas, there's such a great diversity in the Himalayan region that we really do have to be attentive to matters of space and place and the specificities of place in particular, and thinking about how that informs our understanding of identities and contexts, right? And the contextualization of different practices and people in these different places. I'll throw the ball to you, Megan.
Yeah, that's great. To add to what Jessa just said, I mean, I find this idea of peripherality and also emplacement to just be so interesting, and this region is such an interesting place to explore it, because I mean, in my experience, people, and I think probably for you too, Jessica, correct me if I'm wrong, but I mean, people, for example, Nepal is always, if we can invoke the place as having some agency, people there are always aware of the fact that they are peripheral to India, for example, right? Or peripheral to China. You know, China is invoked, India is invoked as these really large places that have these gravitational centers, and that the cultures and the politics of those places have a direct impact on Nepali people's lives, right? And yet Nepali, in my experience, people in Nepal feel that they are absolutely at the center as well, right? That their center, they're the center of, you know, these deep, long-standing religious traditions, their cultures and so forth. And of course, those, I say those in the plural because there are many different cultures there as well. But so this push and this back and forth between feeling peripheral or marginal or conceptualizing oneself, one's community, one's tradition that way, and then feeling the opposite is something I think that generates really interesting social practices and cultural practices and ultimately religious practices and discourses. And we see it, and I think that the theme of peripherality, even more than emplacement, although that's related, is, you know, we see it all throughout this region. We see it in South Asia, for example. If we look at a place like Kashmir, Indian Kashmir, for example, you know, I had the pleasure to be able to travel there a few years ago, and it's really clear that people there feel not only that they're at the margins, but they're in a different place. They understand India. They might understand Kashmir as occupied territory. A number of people do, even if for those who don't experience it in that way, still India itself is something different. They feel peripheral to India and Delhi, as they would invoke it, as the political center, cultural center. But then they also are kind of their own center in a way. And how that all plays out politically in South Asia, of course, we know is pretty profound. And so it just, the politics of all of this is very interesting too. And that's something that that our essays don't get into so much, but of course, nothing about religion is really ever apolitical. And so these are about deeply, they're about not even problematic political issues, but just deeply complex political issues as well. This whole periphery, and margin discussion. And then one quick thing about emplacement I wanted to say too is just, I think that one of the most interesting questions in religious studies being asked now and explored by scholars is what's the relationship between a person or a community and the place in which they're situated? Especially we look at diaspora communities or religious communities in America that fit into minority categories. I mean, this critical relationship and this ongoing negotiation of the critical relationship between person and place or community and place, I think is yielding some really interesting new ideas and insights in the broader field of religious studies. So hopefully if we can contribute some tiny little drop of into that conversation, then I'll feel that this volume has achieved some of what we wanted to achieve.
Yeah, I think you certainly accomplished that. I hope other people will take it up and read through some of these chapters. I'm wondering if you guys now, being post-book, if there's any kind of reflections you might have on the process of co-editing. What did you learn? What worked for you? What are some best practices, perhaps things to not do? I'm sure other people listening are either thinking about or doing the same thing. So what might you tell them?
I think the first thing that I would tell anyone who's considering co-editing a volume would be to make sure your co-editor is someone that you really, really like. I mean, honestly, we spent a lot of time together, not always physically together, but a lot of time on the phone and emailing and whatnot. And because, you know, we genuinely like each other and we communicate well together and have a similar take on life, I guess, and work and all of that, it worked really well for us. I think choosing the wrong person would be utterly disastrous. So that would be my first piece of advice.
Well, I would agree with that. And it was such a pleasure to work with you, Jessica. Not just because, yeah, I mean, we get along and I think we like each other and have similar views and things, but also I think we had I think this would be something to consider anytime you're taking on an edited volume, is we had other research goals that we were pursuing at the same time that we were aware were important to each other, you know, and so we had both a sense of humor about and a kind of, I think, kind of realistic view of how long it might take an edited volume to come together. And we were willing to be flexible with one another about that. You know, these things can take a lot longer because you're marshaling work from people around the world and on different timelines. And I so appreciated the kind of flexibility that we were able to have with one another, both in our editorial work and just in recognizing that these things, you know, edited volumes are sometimes projects you have going on, we have something else going on. And so you have to be realistic about how long they can take, and maybe sometimes a bit longer than you might expect. I think too, whether it's co-editing or editing in general, make sure you would like to edit. Because, you know, it's not just about bringing together this great work, but you work really carefully with the authors, or ideally you do. And for me, and Jess, you might want to say something about this too. I don't want to speak for you, but I loved reading my colleagues' work, mm-hmm. and I loved editing their work because it was just such a pleasure to be able to think about ways that they might shape their work differently and then actually see how they would change it, sometimes in direct response, sometimes not. It was a really rewarding, collaborative, kind of synergistic process, both with the authors and then, you know, when you have a co-editor and someone who is as brilliant and hardworking as my co-editor, Jessica, then it's fun because you're helping to bring into being new work, which it's really rewarding, but you have to like editing. So if you like editing, then it's great.
Yeah, I would echo that entirely. You know, it is a lot of work, whether or not you're doing it with a co-editor or solo. But it was incredibly gratifying, and I learned so much. And that was really satisfying, and just made it all the more engaging, that there were such rich contributions and such lovely people to work with, and having a co-editor to have a conversational partner to talk through these different pieces, to think about the themes and to think about the kind of contribution that we wanted the volume to make together. It was just an incredibly satisfying project. It's certainly not without its frustrations throughout the whole process, because things do take a lot longer and, you know, there are hiccups along the way, as with anything, but it was absolutely fantastic.
Now, before I let you guys go, people are probably interested in what you two are up to as well. So I was wondering if you could tell us a little bit about projects you're working on now or things that you have coming out that we could get our eyes on.
So I am thrilled to announce that my book is due out in March 2018 from Oxford University Press. It's called Reciting the Goddess, Narratives of Place and the Making of Hinduism in Nepal. And it is the larger piece out of which the chapter in Religion and Modernity in the Himalaya stems from. But it traces the history and development of this goddess tradition, the goddess Swastani, and specifically her textual devotional tradition, the Swastani Vratakatha, from the 16th century up to the present day, looking at the different moments of textual expansion and other twists and turns throughout the textual history of the text, but then of the goddess herself and her iconography and so on, that I present both as a case study in and of itself, because virtually no research has been done on this goddess, but also looking at, though there is a little bit of good research that focuses on her ritual tradition, but nothing that's been focusing specifically on the goddess or her textual tradition. And this is a text that's read every winter over the course of a month. And this practice has, as far as we can tell, has an unbroken history from the late 16th century up to the present day. But I use the text also as a lens through which to look at the formation of Hindu identity in Nepal vis-a-vis Hindu identity in India. And I do this by mapping the history and development of the text onto the history and development of Nepal as a political entity and its development as a Hindu kingdom, to see where conversations that were happening in the region and locally, we can see those conversations being taken up by the text and its audience and playing out and being different ideas and articulations of Hindu identity being promulgated through the text and its annual recitation. So that's coming out in March, and I'm very excited about that.
Yeah, congratulations.
And thank you. And looking forward, starting some new projects, also focused on women and gender, Hindu women and gender in Nepal, women's movements, the third sex, the third gender, in the Nepali context. And we'll see where how those all take shape, in the near future.
Yeah. I am working, I've got a couple of new things that I'm working on and I'm excited about. So a large amount of my work to date has focused on Islam and Nepal, Islamic traditions in urban Nepal, and looking at reform and revivalism and politics of identity, Hindu-Muslim relations and so forth. So I'm hoping to start a new project, a smaller project on girls and madrasas in Nepal, and work with people in the community there to try to document and start studying what's taking place in these educational institutions for women in Nepal. I'm also, and this is related to the book project or the book that we just discussed, is I'm really excited to be doing another collaborative project, but on a smaller scale, with Jacqueline Fuchs, who I mentioned earlier, who has worked on Ladakh and a number of other things, but we're putting together a special issue for the journal Himalaya on the Himalayan Ummah. So we're doing somewhat kind of the same thing that Jessica and I did with the book, but on a smaller scale and specific to Islamic traditions and Muslim cultures. So I'm writing a piece for that that actually is trying to conceptualize the Himalayas from as an Islamic space. So what that would mean, what that would require, what that would entail. And then I have a larger project and interest in religion and the body that I'm developing, that's in its very early stages. So it's a lot of exciting things I'm hoping to be doing in the next few years.
Yeah. Well, good luck on all these projects. And I think hopefully people both in South Asian studies and religious studies more generally will get their hands on some of this work. So thanks so much for making the time to talk.
Thank you, Krista. Thanks so much for having us and giving us the opportunity to talk about it. It's great.
Thanks for listening to my conversation with Megan Adamson Sijoputi and Jessica Van Tine Birkenholz about their great edited volume, Religion and Modernity in the Himalaya. It was published by Routledge in 2016.